following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
It's the Stone Cold and Jackal Show!
Really? That's what you came up with for our intro?
Hey friends, so this week we have part two of Max Gale. We're super excited to share that with you. Also excited to see some friends this weekend in Boston and Syracuse. There's some tickets left, stonecoldandthejackal.com if you're interested. And without further ado, here is Mr. Gale. Had you done any sort of
No, but I had a flair. I had a connection to humor, you know.
Yeah.
And when I got into Cuckoo's Nest, I found some great laughs for the Chief and the McMurphy relationship and stuff. And you know, when I was in sixth grade down in Florida, they did a school play, our class play for the school, that was all about duck and cover, you know.
Okay.
And nobody wanted to play the part of the guy who was just the big braggadocio. He's not, you know, he makes fun of everybody and all of that. And then when the siren goes off, he freaks out.
Mm.
And the teacher said, Max, would you play this? Because nobody else wants to do it. And I was, in the groove that if the teacher asks you to do it,
you do it.
And so I remember, though, at the moment when that change happened, and I started running around, help, help, like that. And I heard this sound. I didn't know what it was at first, but I knew it felt good.
Yeah.
And then I realized, oh, they're all laughing.
That's awesome.
That was my first moment of really connecting, you know, where.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, you know, I think actually with Barney Miller, they had done, Danny Arnold, who created it, and he had a partner, and he'd done the pilot once. It didn't get picked up. He bought out his partner, made a deal with ABC, I've learned recently that the reason ABC could try a little outlier thing like that, they wouldn't pay for doing film, they wouldn't pay for any names, but they'd give it a shot on tape, was because they had this cash cow of General Hospital.
with
Luke.
Yeah.
Who
absolutely.
I took a master's class, Lee's master class. Tony was in that class. You know, I just remember how committed he was to his.
Did you have the long hair then too? Did you and Tony have like same length hair?
I don't think I did then.
Came later?
Yeah. No, I had it earlier. I mean, you know, to me it was all, I just, you know, when it's time for a haircut for some reason, then cut it.
Okay.
It was not just growing.
It was long when I got the Barney Miller part. So I guess when I went in red, I probably had long hair. I probably had a beard. I don't know. But the one thing Danny said, you showed me there's a different way to do it. Because he had said, I had this part cast. He's directing a play. Charlie Hayde, who eventually then was in Hill Street Blues, you know, a wonderful actor. But
that's a great compliment, though, as an actor, for someone to say that.
Yeah. I think most of the good gigs I've gotten, and this has probably happened to you guys, have been, you know, they said, you know, we had something else in mind, but then you came in and did it better.
Awesome.
Brought something to it.
Yeah.
Which is why you never want to just try to serve what's.
Bradford. Yeah, no, we've talked a lot about this. It's an easy trap to fall into when you start thinking about, okay, well, this reads like they probably want this. And instead of thinking about, what does this bring out of me?
Yes. It's easy to do. And it's a human thing. You know, it's like the people-pleasing kind of
thing. Well, yeah, a lot of actors are people-pleasers, right?
It's not, you know, acting is not as different from just being alive as. For the most part,
yeah.
I think, you know, people say, oh, are you concerned about getting typecast? Well, not anymore. Everybody's getting typecast in life, you know, unless you break out of it.
Yeah.
You know? And so you got the
job.
Yeah, I got the job. And I remember by then I had thought, OK, I'll take the pilot. I'm going to go up to Big Sur. I had this image of a place that was kind of a basement of a big house that had an upright piano in it and a mattress, you know. That's what I was going to, and they wanted me to sign a 9-month option.
Okay.
And I didn't want to commit to anything that long, I signed a 3-month option. They cut, they said, well, then they're only going to pay you this much. Because Danny didn't want to lose another
actor. Oh, right, because he lost.
I saw Charlie a while back on a Charlie Haight on an audition, and he told me, he says, Danny told him, you'll never work in this town again. Danny was really pissed at him.
Oh, wow.
You know. But he was mercurial. He would get over it quickly. But and he was a great guy and a great talent. He was, you know, every bit as in terms of insight into the human being.
Yeah.
And acting, totally different personality, but he had all those things that Strasberg had.
Yeah.
His great insights into what makes people tick that so anyway, I did it and the pilot got picked up. It was a 2-episode pilot. It got picked up while we were doing the second episode.
Oh, wow.
So I thought, oh, well, what the hell?
Sure.
And I did the first half season. And then I was having fun.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Did you like the process? Did you like the sitcom process?
You know, the process changed for us, and we were a part of changing it in a way. The first, we would have audiences come in the first half season. But often we'd end up doing a whole lot of it after.
Ah.
And Danny was—he had been an editor as well, and a writer and director. So he hated the switch feed, kind of. We're going to this shot and then that shot, and then once in a while we'd do a pickup, or sometimes we'd take a moment and repo a camera.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have a camera to pick up Uncle Walt coming in the door. So you'd kind of stop, and then they'd repo, and then count down, and it was this feeling like, did someone just get abducted? Did our memories just get erased first? You know, what's strange, you know? And so we would end up doing a lot of it afterward again.
Ah.
And also he hated that he would only, you know, be able to kind of do little fixes on that. So he's credited with being the first one to have the quad and bring it down on the set. Because we would be, you know, on blocking day when you're just supposed to move.
Yeah.
And I was probably the worst offender in this, but then you realize, you know, we don't have this moment worked out here, actually.
Right.
We don't really quite know, you know, and somebody.
You're asking questions back then, weren't you?
Yes.
Still always a troublemaker, Max.
All I knew, I didn't have the craft of anybody else. And I just knew to find belief.
Sure.
Because that, you know, was Stanislav, he said, you know, that because Cuckoo's Nest was a geez, I'm picking up a little mic here. What's the word for a melodrama?
Okay, yeah.
And melodrama has to be done with total belief.
Mm.
Okay, and that's really what I had to bring to Cuckoo's Nest. And Tanny, that's really just what can there be about this that then I can believe it? And so I think I brought that, whereas other people had a lot of craft. You know, Ron Glass had done a lot of Shakespeare, and Hal Linden had been a musician and done a lot of Broadway theater. And so there was a lot of craft. So there was something in the way people were doing that was like, do it like a sitcom.
Just timing and following the rules.
You know, and I was trying to figure out Wojo from a standpoint of my own feelings about Vietnam and what, you know.
Well, was probably a good juxtaposition between some of the standard delivery of some of the sitcom characters versus this guy that kind of disrupts that a little bit, right? Maybe?
Yeah. Well, I think just in the process of doing it.
Yeah.
Just in the process of doing it, we found a different way of connecting, because all those guys could play straight cops and straight, you know what I mean? If I had a contract, which was, I think, sometimes I was definitely the one that was, oh, no, we don't have the scene yet. I don't think, well, what about, you know,
Yeah.
So was it the same where kind of Monday you do the read through and then
Tuesday and Wednesday you do
the blocking?
Until the first season when the show had been on the air. And then people came in and they laughed so easily at almost anything. We would end up doing it again. Finally, we said, let's just not even bother with the audience. We've got our audience here. We've got our camera guys and stuff. You know, it's like then it's more on the behavior each scene rather than are you hitting that punchline, you know, and and then ultimately we stopped because we would still, you know, honor the old 3 days of rehearsal and, you know, and And finally just said, you know, let's just rehearse a couple of days and shoot for a couple of days. And that's how we
wow,
did
that's
the last
pretty cool.
few years.
Yeah. How many seasons did it end up going?
7.5.
Wow.
You know, which was pretty much what shows did then.
Yeah.
But around that time, then NBC had Cheers. It was the number one show. We never cracked the top 10.
Oh, sorry.
We were always you know, 11. But we got Peabody Awards.
There you go.
Yeah. We got one Emmy. But we
so
got
what
Peabody
year did
Awards.
That start, Max?
I think it was like 75 or 6.
75.
And
then,
through to 82. And then somewhere in there.
At some
like
point,
that.
When did it go into reruns? Do you even know?
Oh, while we were.
Why? Because I remember,
we on,
I remember Barney Miller
yeah,
growing up.
Yeah.
So my stepdad must have been watching reruns because I was 5 in 75, so
yeah. Right.
Oh, well, maybe not.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. 80 could have been, yeah.
Certainly
I mean,
it was
just, I remember it was always on
yeah.
the TV.
Yeah. It was, I was told it was the biggest syndication deal ever until Cosby came along and,
okay,
and
yeah.
eclipsed that.
It was
so
the
it
biggest
was on,
syndication
deal. So they had to get their money out of
deal
it. So it was showing twice a night in most cities and stuff.
For the producers and the creators got the biggest deal, not the actors.
No. We got a lot of rerun.
Sure,
you know,
residuals,
but
yeah.
No, we didn't have a piece of the show. I never, yeah. You know, there was a point where my agents were, you know, saying, you know, this might be a good time for you to ask for a piece of the show, and I just kind of felt like, you know, I didn't take all that risk, and
sure.
You know, I didn't. I kind of stepped in, and I just didn't feel right about doing that, and I'm not sure they were right, you know,
right,
but. You know, I had times when suddenly my life became about, you know, I had about 5 years where I pretty much didn't work and just dealt with, you know, and, you know, terminal illnesses are not cheap, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So there were a few times I revisited various decisions on my own part, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
But not, you know, only enough to go, I wouldn't change anything there, you know.
How your life changed a bunch from that show, I would guess, right? Like what
oh,
was
yeah.
what was in that age when there were only a few networks and whatever eyes were on the entertainment industry, at least the TV part of it, were on you guys. Like
yeah,
what,
it was huge shift that I hadn't really thought about because
sure.
I hadn't been watching any TV for a long time. I grew up watching it all the time, but so it was strange, you know.
I can imagine.
It was so fast the response from people, but also because I had started writing songs, and somebody that I was seeing was a good friend of Buffy St. Marie, who was a singer songwriter, Native American singer songwriter. Who, you know, there was a time where it was Buffy and Joan and Bob Dylan, you know, kind of were the folkies. And then Buffy, because her songs became more and more just in your face or out front about how Indian people have been dealt with and what yeah. all that reality was mm-hmm. about, why she got kind of blacklisted from the radio.
Yeah.
Although at that time she was on Sesame Street.
Oh.
With her husband, Sheldon Wolfchild, and their baby. So she
yeah.
kind of found a gig. Buffy's an extraordinary person. She's a couple of years older than I am, and she just recently... 2 years ago, I think, or a year and a half ago, won the Canadian Best Rock Album of the Year.
Wow.
Really?
Incredible
That's awesome.
Energy, you know. But my friend who had worked on tours like the Stones and Seals and Crofts and stuff, so she was working with her girlfriend Buffy to put together a tour to Australia. And she shared some of my songs that I'd just made a tape of with Buffy, and Buffy invited me to be her opening act because they were starting to show Barney Miller down there. You know, I suspect my sort of girlfriend at the time probably said, you know, Buffy, if I go down to Australia with you and Max has the summer off, you know, he's going to just be.
She didn't trust you is basically what
she
did.
Trust me. You know? I mean, there was
close.
No reason for her to trust me. But anyway, that the tour didn't happen, but I went up to talk to her like a kind of a final time. She was recording an all-Indian band she wanted to take. And then another guy who was an Indian, kind of a Woody Guthrie of the Indian movement, named Floyd Westerman. You might have, if you saw Dances with Wolves, Floyd played the old chief in that.
Oh,
he was
wow.
in The Doors. He did, you know, he ended up having somewhat of an acting career. But Floyd was known really around the world to indigenous people. And he is a wonderful singer. And mm-hmm. his music was pretty much expressing how Native people felt about the world and what was in it and how to survive. And we just became really good friends. And when the tour didn't happen, we started driving around. I took him up to connect with Kesey up in Oregon, and then he drove me out. We drove out to Denver to meet with his friend Vine Deloria, who is a Native American author and writer and thinker, you know, who was just a great intellectual leader and did a lot of the underpinning of what at that time was a reassertion of sovereignty rights, you know, of treaty rights. 1978, the Indian Freedom of Religion Act was passed, so it was now legal for Indian people to practice their own religion. Until 1978, you couldn't have a sun dance, you couldn't have a sweat lodge, you couldn't do any of the, you know.
Right. Why? Why?
Because there was this effort to break the culture, you know.
So they couldn't do any of that even on their own reservations?
No. That was a deal that was made.
I don't know if it was a deal.
That wasn't a deal. It was just an authoritative, you know, that's how you break people who have had, you know, because there was no real There were people who got what it was with Native people right away, you know, the Indian lovers. Mm-hmm. Oh, he went Native, you know. There were people who got it upon landing, upon connecting. Wow, these people have profound stuff going on, but the dominant direction of that cultural clash was one of domination.
Right.
And, you know, it was a Holocaust.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really any other way to... Yeah. And so I went to, you know, my first powwow at Assistant. I went up, there was my first time at Sundance, my first time in the Sweat Lodge. And for me, I'd been through, you know, growing up in a church with a lot of, you know, most teachings, most religions, there's kind of a universal to it all, right? Mm-hmm. You know? but then I'd kind of gone off on a more of a science trajectory and then, Carl Jung and, you know, trying to figure out something. But I found that there were things that just brought it all together, you know. And also, those were the days of, you know, it's communist versus capitalism.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You know, and my favorite line on that is, the difference between communism and capitalism is capitalism is man exploiting man, and communism is just the other way around.
Right.
You know, those are ways of thinking about things that came with the Industrial Revolution and with just a break in the connection that human beings have had as being a part of life and related to each other. And also, so it was a very profound time, and it gave me, because of this...
Cool TV job you had?
Cool TV job. And I was at, you know, like they did a TV guide interview.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like the guy told us, he had figured out this whole story. Like I was from Grosse Pointe, which
Instead of Grosse Isle.
I was from Downriver, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like this really smart guy who was playing this really dumb guy. And I didn't feel that way about it at all.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I wrote a rhyme for him and sent it in to him, and I can still remember it. It went, "The writer I can least abide the writer I can least abide who takes the story I confide, who thinks that he is on my side, takes the story I confide and fixes it for TV Guide." Now, I don't want to start a fight. Life involves much deeper plight. But even in his narrow light, couldn't he get my hometown right?
No, that's awesome.
You know?
Wow. So I was connecting with these people that while doing Cuckoo's Nest in San Francisco, there was an occupation of Alcatraz, a bunch of native people, because the feds had abandoned the island as a prison.
Right.
And then there was, you know, and then when I was doing the play in New York, there was Wounded Knee was going on, which was a lot like Standing Rock, let's say, that happened. You know, it was something going on that captured the news, that even though what was coming out in the news was pretty much the government feed, the population was kind of more on their side. And so I met through that time, I met those guys, you know, and it gave me a connection into something, you know, just in my own life, spiritually, and also with a thinking about how we share resources, how we move forward. It was just, so there was all of all of that going on for me. You know,
wow, that's a lot going on to be in a very successful show and affecting your own finances and seeing like – or just that and then having that happening at the same time for you is a really fascinating combination
of
things.
Yeah, and in the Indian world, there's a great humor is very big in the Indian world. You know, we have this idea of Indians as very stoic. And they'll clam up if they feel they're around people who are clueless, you know. but in the Indian world, humor is really big, you know. The more serious the moment is, the more important it is to have humor. There are, in Lakota, they call it tahanshi. It's kind of like a cousin relationship. But the relationship of tahanshi is to tease. If a guy's up getting honored, you know, the tahanshi might say that. You might want to let that belt buckle out. That belt out a little loose. You know, it's
sure.
a teasing relationship that keeps everybody in a good place with each other, you know.
Yeah.
And if you're an ally, you know, that word gets out. And for me, I was also at a place where in my own drinking and drugging now I had a paycheck. I had a, you know, it's kind of like the John Belushi syndrome, you know, who's going to tell you that you don't have it all together because
right.
you know you're the party.
You're
you
the
can
man.
Be.
Yeah.
And so it really, you know, opened that path up for me as something much more grounded and much more important.
Quick break here to talk about RX bars. So our drummer Dickie from Pork Chuck was always the guy with the best snacks. They were always delicious and nutritious. And so when he came onto the bus with these bars, I knew I had to pay attention. They were RX bars. Now, RX bars are easily identified because they have the ingredients printed in bold right on the wrapper. And there aren't that many ingredients because they don't have anything artificial, like artificial colors, artificial flavors, preservatives, or fillers. None of that. They're also gluten-free, soy-free, and dairy-free. But you only see the ingredients that you want to see, the ingredients that matter, like egg whites for protein, dates to bind, nuts for texture, and other delicious ingredients like unsweetened chocolate, real fruit, and spices like sea salt or cinnamon. Now, the adult flavors, they have 14 delicious flavors for adults. Peanut butter chocolate, chocolate sea salt, blueberry, mixed berry, coconut chocolate. I like the peanut butter chocolate myself. But they also have a kid line, which was so exciting for me to see. And they have great flavors for the kids. Chocolate chip, PB&J, double chocolate chip, peanut butter chocolate. My kids like the chocolate chip. I like the PB&J, but the kids' bars are great because they're a little softer. The nuts are chopped up into smaller pieces. They're a little smaller. So perfect for kids, perfect for on the go, and you know exactly what's in them, and that is a relief. Sometimes it's these kid snacks. There's like 80,000 ingredients, and this you can see exactly what it is, all the good stuff. An RX bar is offering our listeners an exclusive pack of 6 adult bars and 4 kid bars so the whole family can enjoy for 25% off. If you go to rxbar.com/Steve and Brad and enter Steve and Brad at checkout, you're going to get 25% off an order of 6 adult bars and 4 kid bars, 10 bars for the whole family to enjoy. So go to rxbar.com/Steve and Brad, all one word, Steve and Brad, and enter Steve and Brad at checkout. Back to Max.
How are we doing time?
We're fine. We're fine.
I haven't talked this much about myself.
No, it's great. Yeah. It's great because I know you and I actually have to block in a little while. So,
yeah.
But, you know, it's just – go ahead. You can finish what you were saying. We definitely have a little more time. So.
Okay. Well, I – so that kind of opened that
– road.
That road.
Yeah.
And so I still have a lot of relation. And I heard – you know, almost from the beginning, and here's a man who's done great things for our people. You know, it's always been more the other way. You know, in terms of what I've
learned,
what I've gotten from it, and then later when you know we had run into these things with my wife and all, I really had a support and a way to go through it and be with it, you know, here we are, here Standing Rock coming. Interesting, wonderful, I think, that a lot of Standing Rock came, the push for it came from the women.
Mm.
And while there were women behind Wounded Knee, when you've heard the stories about, you know, some of the elder women saying, are the men going to do anything about what's going on here? But it was still very male-dominated and male-dominated. male, you know, and certainly in terms of how the news handled it, well, you know, they're going to acknowledge the Indian, the chiefs, the guys, you know,
sure.
that's who the Indian leaders are, you know, even though there were women that were part of it. So, and I think it's, you know, Native people are in the blind spot of America, and, you know, that wonderful experiments in class where you'd show where your blind spot was because you don't see the pencil, you know,
sure.
somewhere
kinda,
over here.
It's kind of interesting that you're bringing this up because some friends of ours, they do a lot of mission work on a reservation mm-hmm. in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me about they've been doing it for 25 years
mm-hmm.
with the people there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me about it, and it was like, how is this even going on, first of all?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm like, man, I got to do something to help. I want to help, you know. And I said, what's the biggest need? Because as you know, there's this specific reservation doesn't even have a school.
Uh-huh.
I mean.
Do you know which one it is by any chance?
I don't know the exact. It's in Arizona. Mm-hmm. I don't want to misspeak on mm-hmm. and sound like a, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. someone who's uninformed because I am a little uninformed.
You can't help but be in this country unless you've
yeah,
made
and
the
I just,
connection.
You know, it's like I go, what do you mean you stay on the reservation? He goes, yeah, there's a few little, you know, kind of small hotels you can stay on and you travel around to different places. And I said, but what's the biggest need? And this is something that I've been thinking about for, you know, for doing some work for them. And he said, shoes.
Uh-huh.
He's like, these kids need shoes.
Mm-hmm.
We go down there with hundreds and hundreds of pairs of shoes and supplies because they just don't have. And I go, I don't even get how this is pot. I don't even understand it, you know. And it's just really opened my eyes. Up. And mm-hmm. so I'd love to talk to you more outside the podcast about this stuff, uh-huh. Max, because it's just very intriguing. And it's like you could really do something in these people's lives.
I mean, one of the things that came out of this reassertion of sovereignty rights then was, of course, the casinos. I mean,
right.
over time. So there are now Indian communities, you know, up in Oneida, Wisconsin, that they're the biggest employer in the county. It used to be the poorest community in the county,
right.
you know.
Yeah.
And there are lots of things that come with cash flowing, you know, that
sure.
bring their own challenges and stuff. And then there are a lot of smaller, especially southern Arizona, and of course the Navajo Reservation is the biggest.
Yeah.
But incredible poverty, you know,
yeah.
Pine
incredible
Ridge,
poverty,
you know, and this legacy of, you know, yeah, I mean, it's just it just really is. We have an awful.
I mean,
awful
it is a smaller res that you're talking mm-hmm. about because there's a very small casino there mm-hmm. that they don't make a lot of money.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And but just imagine if you could figure out how to put a school there
mm-hmm.
on what difference you'll make generations ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. And there are incredible people in any world. I mean, not just really, you know, like well-educated, incredible minds and people working on these in
absolutely.
An ongoing way, trying to keep the pipelines from coming through their land and,
yeah.
you know, and so there's something, you know, very heartening about it and also disheartening.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
But before we close, I would love to share one of my little short rhymes because some of them are long. But, you know.
Let me ask this question first and then you can finish with that.
Okay.
How did the whole Nurses Ball, because that was like one of the most talked about performances, was it with you and Maurice? Because
uh-huh.
you've played piano, you've sang. Maurice really hasn't sang a lot. So, and I know he was so nervous.
Yeah.
I've never seen him actually more nervous
uh-huh.
than when he was going to have to sing.
Uh-huh.
You know,
he was
so,
wonderful though. What I
yeah, it was
made
great
it
because
seen.
You guys connected on such a human emotional level that people felt that.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't listening to, oh, is he in key or what's going on here? You know, and it was great. So just tell.
All right, so I went to Frank. I said one thing. I said, I'd like to know where this arc is going. And he said, we're trying to figure it out. And I said, and also, what have you guys thought about music? Because it seemed like common knowledge that music can be the last thing to go. It can help people, you know, regain connection.
Yeah.
Music and old people, particularly with dementia. He said, He said, "Why do you want to sing?" You know, Frank, not much for a lot of chit chat. Yeah. Why do you want to sing? Do you sing? I said, "Well, I do." I said, "If you said, can I sing?" I'd say that's a matter of opinion, but but I do anyway. He said, maybe something. I thought he said the nurse's party. I didn't know. I was right, picturing, you know, maybe at some point.
That's a different storyline.
Mike would get over it. Turned out he knew a little song on the piano or something like, you know. I said, because I write songs. Oh, you want to do one of your songs? I said, well, I don't know that that would be right for Mike. You know, it seems like he might know a standard or something like that. He says, yeah, maybe a Sinatra tune or something like that. And he said, yeah, that could be expensive. So anyway, I thought about it for a while. And then I thought, I said, I've got a song of mine that might have been a Sinatra tune, because I had this song.
The same feel?
Well, in a way, but yeah. Even more so, in the early days of Barney Miller, they had the whole cast on the Dinah Shore show.
Oh,
long before your time, but
I remember
that was
the
afternoon TV, you know, and they had us each do something, and I did a poem, which I got a lot of letters for, but I did a song, I got one letter, but it was from a guy named Gordon Jenkins. He said, your song stood out like a laughing pallbearer. It's called We're Going to the Ocean By and By. And he said, I wonder if you would be willing to come by my home, and I'd like to make a recording of that. And I asked around, and people said, Gordon Jenkins. So he was like the Quincy Jones of his era. He was
A
conductor, composer, and arranger for Judy Garland and Frank Sinatra.
Right.
He did the last album he did with Sinatra. The hit that came off of it was that it was a very good year.
Yeah.
When I was 17. Oh, yeah. You know, and that whole string, da, 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 that yeah. whole string,
yeah,
that's classic Gordon Jenkins. So,
oh, wow.
So I went and met him and he recorded that and three or four other songs. And he says, you know, I'd like to get this song to Mr. Sinatra. He was very gracious, that old sort of.
So it might, it could have been a Sinatra song, yeah.
Yeah, he said, well, I have to wait a little bit because his mother was just died in a plane crash. So we'll probably need to wait about 5 or 6 months, you know. And I said, well, you know, okay. At that time, Sinatra, you know, he'd gotten pissed off at JFK because JFK stood him up.
Oh, wow.
He was supposed to stay at Sinatra's in Palm Springs, and Bobby Kennedy, I learned this story recently. Bobby Kennedy said, you can't do that. He's tight with this Chicago mobster that you're boffing, the same gal that he's boffing. You know, and you cannot go. And he went to Bing Crosby's place instead. And,
By
this time now, Sinatra was in with Nixon. And all. So for me, that's kind of like a, in a hippie era. You know, it was like Frank Sinatra. I don't know. Sinatra.
Yeah,
you know, I like, you know. And then that's when Buffy put that invite out, and I met Floyd. And so I never got back to Gordon Jenkins.
Oh, wow.
I would see his daughter in the market every once in a while. You know, my dad said to say. So
So did you record the song with him or
no? No, I didn't record it with him. I did years later, after Barney Miller, I got together, at my wife pushed this, and she got together with Merle Saunders, who was a friend of mine, a wonderful Bay Area musician, said, we got to get Max to record some songs. So we got some players together, and that was one of them. And some of the Merle and Chris Mostert, who was playing the sax and flute parts, and both wanted to do a string section. I said, this song really could use a string section. And I told him about that story about Gordon Jenkins. And after they got telling me how far up my backside of my head was, you know, I said, well, call him. So I called him, and his wife answered, oh, yes, Max, Gordon speaks of you often. I said, to explain it to her, she said, oh, I'm sure you would love to do that. He can't come to the phone right now because he has throat cancer, so he can't speak. But if you could come over tomorrow. I said, well, I'm just leaving on an early flight for New York to do this play, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's going to run a long time. The idea was do it for 2 weeks and tape it
right.
for PBS or something like that. And so I was in New York like 3 or 4 nights, ended up in a theater bar like Elaine's or something, you know, with a bunch of people, and then some Tin Pan Alley guys kind of moved their tables in, and I was talking with them, and then one of them went, oh, did you hear about Gordon?
Oh,
I said,
man.
Are you talking about Gordon Jenkins? Yeah. He says, you mean because he's sick? No, he passed away last night.
Oh.
It was a great a lesson for me. And like, what do you, where do you, you know, where does creativity stop, not make those kind of judgments and divisions, you know? But anyway, they decided to come up with a story where I actually do a Frank Sinatra song.
Okay.
Which I thought, I'm not, you know, but I, when they wrote, I wrote it with that scene that comes in, you know, I thought this is, this makes it a scene.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It's not just this actor showing that he can sing.
Right.
When he,
yeah, it was
really
great.
Can,
it was,
you know,
it was well,
it was a wonderful, wonderful piece. Yeah.
So well done, man. It was so well done. All right, give us your rhyme.
All right, okay.
And then you're kicking me out of my own room.
Okay. But this has been great, man. I haven't
thought about this. Thanks for sharing all that with us, man. You're such a – I mean, you have such – so many great stories that we could talk for hours with you. And you're, I know you're a historian too, so it's like, man, it's just
That's what we – you know, Steve and I love this because we don't set – you know – we don't talk to the person ahead of time and go, hey, let's do, let's talk about this, 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 and this. So we can just kind of go, and it's fun for us to see, you see, you know, we get to know and learn so much more about the people that we're around on a daily basis, and which is pretty unique.
Yeah.
So all I have to ask is that, like, whatever time I got left here, I get to hear your backstory. So, okay, so this is bigger. I call it bigger because it's the first word, but bigger than you. And that could be the capital U that people get hung up on, which you are you praying to, or just the you. Bigger than you, bigger than me. Bigger than all our hearts and minds can see. Bigger than all we believe there to be. Bigger than bondage, bigger than free. Bigger than love, bigger than hate. Bigger than destiny, bigger than fate. Bigger than humble. Bigger than great, bigger than race or religion or state, bigger than teacher or guru or sage, bigger than sex or youth or age, bigger than anger, resentment, or rage, bigger than anything said on a page or a stage, bigger than action, whatever we try, bigger than all we accept or deny, bigger than any one, what, who, or why. Bigger than bigger and bigger than I.
Beautiful.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for sharing that, man. We appreciate that. That's deep.
Cool. Now I got to see your act.
Yeah, no. Well,
I got to see your act.
Nothing near deep.
He'll
be like, well, he might laugh a few times.
You know,
he might laugh a few times.
The best laughs come when something, you know, deep is... is aligned or evoked, don't you think?
Yeah.
You know, the best, you know.
Yeah, thing. Well, I think some of our laughs might be cheap, but some of them but some of them are coming out of a relationship that he and I have built over the years that people know, appreciate, and are happy to be a part of. And so I think that's part of it, too. So there is something deep there.
Well, there's the history there, which people, you know.
Yeah,
you
can, and a if lot they're of, connected a lot of, with you on – a show like this, they're already connected. With
And it's a bit amazing.
Deep, their heart connections are there.
I know. It's been so. It's been such a joy for us to just go out and express ourselves in different ways as actors, and where I don't even want to say we're doing comedy, but we are, because I never want to say, "Hey, I'm a stand-up comedian." They'll be like, "No, you're not, dummy. Sit down." So, but you know, to actually be doing some type of stand-up is scary, but you have an audience who wants to hear from you and wants to laugh with you and cry with you. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like we're sort of on an unfair stage because they want to have fun.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but people have come up afterwards like, man, we didn't know you guys were so funny and we didn't know what to expect. And Bradford sings. He's an amazing singer. He's like, man, the music part was cool. And it's just we get to do this for almost a variety show.
Yeah.
Which we never ever thought we would be doing, but it's so fun. It's so fun, Max.
You did a show with Maurice in Sacramento?
Yes.
That's where I live now.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. So we played that club about 3 weeks before you guys did.
Uh-huh.
And I would have been there, except we were on the road on the East Coast doing our show, or otherwise I would have been there because I would have loved to have seen it. Well, did you guys have a good time?
I had a great time. I think we both did, and I think that people enjoyed it, and it came up from somebody named Linda that I should be talking to or something like that. Linda,
she works. I've worked with her for 20 years.
I'm doing one of the things with
the fantasy weekends.
Yeah, you know, which is kind of grueling and stuff, but it gets me down to Austin.
Sure.
To see my daughter, and it sounds interesting.
Yeah.
But I would love to explore. I'm very intrigued hearing that how much you guys enjoy it.
Yeah,
That there's a receptivity to it because I got my songs and
I think
stuff,
you should
you know,
do some type of one-man show. I think it would be amazing for you to get out there and do it because you can tell stories. You're a great storyteller. Play some music and meet people, and that's what they want. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll hook it up.
All right.
Yeah,
cool.
Buddy.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Max. Max Gale. Whoop, whoop. That's awesome. Thanks, Max, so much.
Thank you.
Wow. What a life, huh?
I mean, good gosh. We could have gotten 7 hours out of him.
I mean,
there's so many experiences in his life, and the time era that he grew up in is pretty crazy. I know a lot of listeners probably have grown up during that time and experienced a lot of those things, but it's just, it's like we didn't experience anything growing up.
Well, I mean,
you know what I mean?
I was born at, you know, Vietnam had ended by the time I was born. I was born in 79. So, like, my parents identified with that generation a bit. And so I heard a little bit about that. And, you know, the music that they listened to helped teach me about that era a little bit, as well as, you know, learning about it in school. But, I mean, he, you know, growing up in the 40s and 50s in the Midwest, then being in college in the 60s, being on the height of network television in the 70s.
I know. It's like you couldn't have,
you know, like
so many
well,
peaks.
And also just, you know, he is such a profound human being. Like he's obviously got an incredible heart and he feels so much and he's got an incredible sense of empathy and you know, like I think that's what makes him such a great actor as well. You know, like you can just tell that the human experience fascinates him and affects him in such a amazing way. And we're so lucky to have him here.
It's so great to do this because you really get to learn more about somebody that you work with that you would never do. You would never take the time.
No.
You know, and the fact that he was like, oh, I want to hear what your guys' story is. So no, you don't, Max.
We just say episode 1 and 2 of the pod. Thanks, Max.
Well, I'll show you how to download that on the iPhone. But it was so nice because I did call him last minute. I'm like, hey.
Yeah. So this is always fun. People always ask us, you know, like, why don't you get this person? Why don't you get this person? And a lot of it is who's around when we're around, because we aren't around.
I mean,
I'm around very rarely, you know. And so, a couple weeks ago, we did our first Skype podcast, and we might do more of those. But it's really fun to be here in the room, and especially when we have guests, that's kind of imperative.
It's awesome.
But so Steve was texting me this morning going, I think we might get this person.
They're out.
Maybe this person.
Nope. So Max is great because he answered the phone and I kind of look at the rundown. I'm like, okay, well, maybe we'll get two or three people today if we can squeeze it in. I mean, it's difficult to do sometimes, but I called to get his number because I didn't have his phone number.
Oh, you get to call here.
Yeah, I called GH to get his number and then I called him and he answered the phone, which is amazing. And I'm like, hey, Max.
Who answers their phone for a number you don't recognize?
Nobody.
Sometimes if it's an area code, like if it's the area code of
your number
or work might come from.
Sure.
Like if in LA, if a 310 number is calling me, chances are I'll answer it
because
my agents and managers are 310.
Right, right.
And like, you know, but.
So he didn't know I wasn't his agent or his manager. He didn't know what I was pulling him into. Because I mentioned to him before, he's like, yeah, I'd love to do it. So I'm like, can you come in early?
Oh, boy.
Today I know your call's like sometime near mine at lunchtime. And he's like, yeah, actually, I was just going to come in anyway to do some work. And sure, I'd love to sit down with you guys.
Wow,
it's
oops,
great.
We ate up his work time. Oops.
I was like, yeah, but oh, well, he loved it. So thanks, Max Gale. It was amazing.
We did a tweet last week. I figured this week we'd do a question.
Okay, let's do a question.
This person is... written to us many times asking this question, so I feel like and I'm not sure if we've answered it before. I don't think so. What was the make and model of your first car?
Oh, I didn't ever answer this question, which is great.
Well, I'm fascinated by it. This is from Kathy. Thank you, Kathy.
Kathy.
What was the make and model of your first car?
So my first car, I wanted it to be, I lived in Chicago. I was going to high school in Chicago. My mom and dad were divorced at the time, and I used to go visit my dad every summer. And I was 15 years old, and I was right about to get my license, and I'm like, man. And I saw a Chevy Nova.
Ooh.
It was probably like a 69 or 70 Chevy Nova, rusted Chicago. Like, the panel was falling off. I'm like, that's my car. I can't wait to get back here and save my money and get a car like this. Well, you know, the story goes that I went to L.A. and I had to call my mom and tell her I wasn't coming home.
Right.
Because I just didn't want to go back. Yeah. I wanted to experience life out here with my dad and just, you know, do something. And so I was going to Beverly Hills High, and I'm like, man, I gotta find a job. I gotta make some money. I gotta get some clothes. I gotta get a car.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird how you start thinking that, right? Because
it's
materialism, and you're like, I gotta get this and this and this. So I rode a bike to school
because I didn't have pimped out bike.
I didn't have
now.
A car, so I ended up saving money and I got a 1973 MGB.
Is that an MG?
MG, yeah, but it was MGB.
Okay, they dropped the B?
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's still on there.
But oh, it is?
It's just MG on the car, but it's an MGB.
Okay.
So
those are cool.
Those were cool. It was a two-seater convertible.
Wow, death trap, but cool.
Complete death trap. And it wasn't really that fast, honestly, for a
well, good.
No, that's not good.
Too much testosterone coursing through your body just wanted to impress the girl.
It was black. It was amazing car.
Did it have a roll bar on top?
No roll bar, no.
Some of them do, though, right?
Some do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah
some
yeah.
do. And so I got that for $1,600.
Wow.
That was my first car.
Wow.
I remember to this day it was in Auto Trader, and it was like, I think it might have been $1,650 or best offer, you know?
Oh, Auto Trader was a periodical. It was a printer.
Go get
– Auto Trader's a website now. And I was like –
No.
I don't think there was the –
They had magazines before the websites.
Well, no, but you said Auto Trader, and I was like, oh, you got it online. Wait a second.
No, you go to 7-Eleven.
There's no
way. 7-Eleven. It wasn't 1972. Dictator. It was 1986.
Okay. Still no interweb.
No.
No.
But you have to go to the convenience store and buy the Auto Trader and look it and call and go see it and go get the freaking –
Go buy a car like a human being.
Mechanical. Yeah, I know. It's crazy. But my dad helped me a lot because he had one. So he already kind of knew the ins and outs. So that was my first car. What about you?
My first car when I turned 16 was a Jeep Grand Wagoneer 1980.
Was it the wood paneled ones?
Yes, dude.
It was?
Yes.
Wait, 1980 what?
1987 is, I think.
Ooh, that's probably a good one.
It was the first year that they had it.
Wow.
And it was like, it was.
Dude, you'd be so pimp if you had that now.
Dude, it's making a, people search them out.
I know. That's
it's like,
cool.
It was like the precursor to the SUV.
Yeah.
Because it was the first.
They were ahead of the game.
Yeah, it was a crap. I mean, like.
Was it garbage mechanically?
Everything was electric.
Oh, so everything shorted out all the
correct.
Time.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the back was – you put the key in and you turned the key and the window went down. But you had to guide it down with your hands.
I remember those.
Because otherwise it would get caught.
Right.
But then you couldn't open your hatch otherwise. You had to – put the key in, turn it so the window would come down.
It's great.
And then to open the hatch to pull it down.
Yeah. So that wasn't really – they didn't figure that part out yet.
Yeah. That was terrible.
Yeah.
But it was cool. It had four-wheel drive, which was kind of a necessity in New Hampshire at the time. Or not at the time. Still is, probably. And it was a tank.
Yeah.
Like, it was.
So you were safe.
I was super safe.
I was not.
And it was a V8.
Ooh, man.
So it, like.
This is so against you. This is so not you right now. You're making me very happy.
Well, but gas was.
I had a V8 SUV. It was a tank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And gas was 99 cents a gallon. So, like, you know, and I think it had something like a 20-gallon tank. Like, I mean, it was stupid how inefficient it was. But it was fun. I mean, it was really fun to drive.
Dude, that's a great car.
And it had electric seats and, you know, like, and I didn't think it was cool, but I really enjoyed driving it. And then it was also the time where you had to put your, like, you had to have your own speakers.
Sure.
So I had to put, so someone built me a box, like a woofer
of
box.
Of course. Or,
that's what you call it?
I've had many, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and then put the speakers in there. And then I had to get a switch.
Yes.
I had to put a switch at my, on my dash to turn on the woofer. Right?
What were you? What were you listening to that actually had any bass in it? Anyway, what? What the heck, dude?
Probably like shy.
Yeah. No, dude.
And, yeah. But so the Switch. It was all relatively cheap stuff.
I
wasn't getting Pioneers. I was getting something else. And I remember the wires. The wires ran from the Switch through my car to the back.
Of course.
They weren't in the car. They were
Yes.
The Switch got stuck once. One of the wires started to melt on my leg. Because it shorted out because the Switch got stuck.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And so, like, I'm driving and my leg's on fire because my subwoofer's trying to play some crap music in the back.
With no bass. They're like, we're tired of this music choice. Yeah. I'm going to burn this bastard.
Well, and of course, the whole interior of the car was, like, carpet.
Sure.
Like, the soft, you know, like, it was all – so, like, I –
That's amazing.
Thankfully, I wasn't on the 405 or something in traffic. I was in New Hampshire on a country road, and I pulled over. But it was rough.
Dude, those stereo days, man, I had every car that I had was pimped out. Yeah. My MG, right? Like behind the seats is where the top would fall into.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
So you take – it's convertible, so you take the top down,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
So there's an empty space. So I had a bazooka tube in there, right? That was so freaking loud. And I put new speakers, and my dad's like, what are you doing? You know, and then I got my when I first came here, one of my first cars I got was a Yukon. One of the very first.
Oh, yeah, the
like,
Chevy Yukon.
Chevy,
yeah.
The GMC, yeah.
Oh,
it was
GMC,
like the
yeah.
Chevy Blazer, but
yeah.
It was – so that was what, 90 – no. Yeah, in the 90s, late 90s. And a friend of mine built stereo systems for cars, for car shows.
Oh, wow.
So this thing was like – it would have cost me like $15,000.
Wow.
So it was like an air compressor.
Yeah.
You know, there were amps for each woofer. It was like a 20-inch woofer in the back of the Yukon. Excuse me. And it would – we'd roll on that thing, dude, and you would feel every time that bass thumped, it would go through your body.
Butt, yeah.
And it was a lease. I leased the car. And they're like
– You can't return it like this.
I did it. They're like, what the hell happened to this? Like everything was rattled off. In the car. All the screws were loose, the panels. And I'm like, hey, I got to turn my car. And they're like, dude, this thing is falling apart.
But look at the sound system
you
got.
They're like, what do you want to do with this? I go, oh, just keep it. They're like, oh, okay. So I'm like, oh,
done deal.
Even. But anyway,
that was
1973 MGB.
Wow.
So.
Yeah.
And you had a Grand Wagoneer.
Dude, it was in that movie with Billy Baldwin and Cindy Crawford. I forget what it was called. But there was – they did like a romantic action comedy or your romantic action movie, and that was their car in it. And but yeah, literally now people buy them. They're like there's like a secondary.
It's on demand.
Car. Yeah. So,
yeah.
But it rusted out. Like yeah. I
well, you're in the Northeast, dude.
Well, yeah, all the salt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
but I had to sandblast it. I remember to get the like I yeah I.
That's amazing.
Like, jobs. So yeah. Well, thank you, Kathy, for taking
yeah,
us
Kathy,
down some nostalgia.
Thank you so much.
Reminiscing about. The old days.
Yeah, man.
Thanks to Max for really, I mean,
yeah,
he really
thanks, Max.
Shared some really cool stuff with us.
Yep.
And he's doing amazing work on our show. And I say our, it's mostly yours.
no, it's everybody's, dude. It's everybody's.
But it's, we're so lucky to have him. We really are.
Yeah. So we got stuff coming up. We're going on the road in January.
Yeah.
We got more stuff happening, which is awesome, and we always appreciate your guys' support. Thank you.
Looking forward to seeing you folks in Syracuse and Boston this weekend. Thank you for your showing up.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
We're going to have a great time.
We're going to have a great time.
Yeah, Saturday, Boston show at 1 o'clock, and then a dinner, and then we're driving to Syracuse.
That's right. StoneColdAndTheJackal.com for dates and all your info that you need.
Yeah.
So
it'll be fun.
Good
we'll
to see you, brother.
Good, time. Good to see you too, man.
Have a great
excited
day.
Excited to bunk with you this weekend.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stay on your side of the room, sir.
Okay. We'll see.
All right, you guys. Have a great day.
Bye.
Bye.